good horse, I call you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune to take the...
A false picture of reality does not happen by nature. It is subsidized, and the banking sector has subsidized a junk economics that is taught in the universities, broadcast from your newspapers, mouthed by the politicians whose election they sponsor, to try to make you believe that you're living on Mars in a different kind of a world instead of the actual country that you're living in, and to pretend that there is no financial class that is trying to grab what belongs to the public at large.
You're listening to episode 611 of Unwelcome Guests, Money as Powerlessness. I'm Robin Upton, and the voice you've just heard was the redoubtable Michael Hudson, summing up a presentation he gave in March 2012 to a conference on modern money theory in Rimini, Italy. It was quite a large conference. I think they booked a sports stadium. A lot of people were interested to hear alternative ideas about money. If you're a familiar Unwelcome Guests listener, then you will certainly not have the learned helplessness, the learned powerlessness, which would have you say, well, I don't know, I'm not an economist, we better leave it to the experts. That is, of course, just the message that the commercially controlled media, the newspapers, television channels of the rich, would like you to have, because they don't want you to think about it and apply your own common sense. So much simpler if the laws of economics were like the laws of gravity, something that everybody had to obey, whether they liked them or not, something that was immutable and God-given. How disturbing to reflect that debt amnesties are a regular feature of world history, as we shall hear in our second hour from David Graeber, something that has popped up whether rulers liked it or not, whenever people felt so dispossessed that they thought they had nothing to lose. Now, we're now going to start with some simple facts laid out by Associate Professor Stephanie Kelton.
I'm going to introduce you to the basics of modern monetary theory in four parts. Modern monetary theory is a revolutionary way to think about the way a modern capitalist economy works. The first part of the talk this morning will focus on money. It's an essential part of the argument. You have to understand the difference between what we're going to call a sovereign money and a non-sovereign money. This afternoon, we'll focus on functional finance, another essential part of modern monetary theory. It is the key to understanding how a modern economy can achieve what has for so long been unthinkable: full employment for all people with stable prices. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the international economy and the way that the domestic economy is related to what happens in the rest of the world. We'll question the conventional thinking about deficits and debt, and we'll focus specifically on the future of Italy. So let's begin with the first lesson. What is money? All money exists as an IOU. It's a debt. When we say IOU, we mean two people are involved in every monetary relationship. The I is the debtor. The U is the creditor. IOU. IOUs are recorded in what we call the money of account. The money of account in Australia is the Australian dollar. The money of account in the U.S., the U.S. dollar. The money of account in Japan, the Japanese yen. In Britain, the British pound. In Italy, the euro. Do you see a difference? You will by the end of this talk. The money of account is something abstract, like a meter, a kilogram, a hectare. It's not something you can touch or feel. It's representational, something that only a human could imagine. In any modern nation, the money of account is chosen by the national government. MMT emphasizes the state's power over money. This is not something new. It dates back as far as Aristotle. You can find it in Adam Smith and in the work of John Maynard Keynes. I will read a brief quote from Keynes, who said, "The age of chartalist or state money was reached when the state claimed the right to declare what things should answer as money of account. Today, all civilized money is beyond the possibility of dispute. Chartalist, state money. A sovereign government defines the money of account. A sovereign government imposes taxes, fees, and other obligations to be paid to the state. A sovereign government decides what it will accept in payment to itself. And a sovereign government chooses how it will make its own payments to others. Most governments in the world today choose their own unique money of account. And they issue their own unique currency. One nation, one money is the rule in almost every corner of the world today. U.S. dollars, bills and coins, Mexican pesos, bills and coins, British pound, notes and coins. Most governments also require that taxes be paid in a currency that the state has the exclusive power to issue. These currencies are sovereign money. As long as the state has the power to enforce its tax laws, the people will need the government's money. The currency will have value. People will work to sell things, goods and services to the government in order to get government money. Whatever the government accepts in payment to itself becomes the ultimate definitive money in the economy. It is the only way to settle a debt. You must use government money. We can imagine in any economy a hierarchy of monies. Anyone can create money, but not all money is created equal. The most acceptable money sits at the top of the pyramid. Those are the IOUs that everyone accepts and everyone must accept. Those are the IOUs that are ultimately needed to pay our debts. Those are the government's IOUs. The rest of us can go in debt, issue IOUs, but our debt is not as good as government debt. It's not as acceptable. It can't be used to pay for things. In the U.S., the hierarchy looks like this. The government's IOU, the United States dollar, sits at the top of the pyramid. It is a fiat currency. The United States government is the monopoly issuer of the U.S. dollar. The only entity on the planet that can legally create the currency. The U.S. government taxes in dollars. It spends in dollars. And it controls its own currency. Why is this important? What are the benefits of issuing your own currency? They are extraordinary. The government, when it issues its own currency and goes into debt in that currency, can always pay its debt, can never go broke, can never run out of money. It can afford anything that is for sale in that currency. It doesn't need to borrow its own currency. And it can set its own interest rate. It does not have to pay what markets want. It does not become a victim to speculation, to bond vigilantes. It has additional policy space. It can do things for its economy and for its people that a government that does not have a sovereign currency cannot do. Think about what the hierarchy would look like under a gold standard. Many governments operated under gold or silver or both for some period of time in our nation's world history. Under a gold standard, the government promises to convert its currency into gold. In that situation, what sits at the top of the pyramid is not the state's currency, but the gold reserves. This means that the government must be careful about how much it spends. If it spends too much of its own currency, it can jeopardize the entire system, because it may not be able to convert currency into gold as promised. You have to limit your spending and limit what you do with your policy. Governments operating under a gold standard do not have sovereign currency. In a similar way, a country that fixes its exchange rate to another country's currency, the way Argentina and Russia and others have done, do not issue a sovereign currency. They must be careful about how much they spend. They must defend the reserves. If you promise to convert your currency into another country's currency, you might go broke. You can run out. How do you get the other country's currency? It requires trade surpluses to earn the other country's currency. You become dependent on the rest of the world and their economic well-being to sustain your own well-being. The hierarchy in a country that operates fixed exchange rates places someone else's currency at the top. You also lose control of your interest rate, something it's crucial to retain control of. If a country is going to have sustainable debt and full employment. The euro is not a fixed exchange rate system, but it's not a sovereign currency either. It's an exceptional case, an unprecedented experiment, where the currency is divorced from the individual nations themselves. The euro is effectively a foreign currency to you. All 17 governments that use the euro are not issuers of the currency, but users of the currency. They lack the powers that a sovereign issuer has. Japan, the United States, the UK, Canada, Australia, these are sovereign issuers. The euro is not a sovereign currency. Governments that adopted the euro must borrow the currency. They must pay whatever the bond markets require. They can run out of money, and they lack the policy space of a sovereign issuer. If you imagine the hierarchy for a member of the Eurozone, such as Italy, You see, the relationship between the government and the currency is different. Italy does not issue the currency that it uses. It is an essential point. Money matters. A sovereign government should be in control of the currency that sits at the top of its pyramid. If it gives up control of a sovereign currency, it also gives up the power to set reasonable policy in its own country. It hands over that power to the bond markets, who ultimately decide how much can be spent, what can be done. Abba Lerner was an economist, a contemporary of John Maynard Keynes. He saw this very clearly. He said, by virtue of the power to create or destroy money by fiat, and its power to take money away from people through taxation, the state is in a position to keep the rate of spending in the economy at the level required for full employment. The problem with the euro is that it cannot be created at will. The governments must go out and get euros from someone else. They've sacrificed their ability to conduct sensible economic policy in every nation, and the effects are clearer now than ever. Thank you.
Thank you to Stephanie Kelton there, Assistant Professor of Economics. Thank you also to Bonnie Faulkner from Guns and Butter, the source of that show. If you'd like to go to your favourite search engine and type in Guns and Butter, I'm sure you'll get there, and plenty more shows of similar import. I hope you found Stephanie Kelton enlightening on some basic points which are never laid out so clearly. I have never heard such talk on the television. A lot of people about the struggle to balance the budget as if it was a household budget and income was fixed and it wasn't possible to create money out of thin air. Well, somebody has to, of course, and that would be the government, unless you're in a Eurozone country, of course, in which case that power has been handed over to the independent central bank. Of course, the central banks are nothing if not highly organized. Their institute of note is the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS. I'm still looking for good audio about the BIS. They seem to be a rather mysterious, but by all accounts highly important and influential organization. Just one that happens to have a very low profile. Now, with events such as the MMT conference reaching a large audience, I hope that they will be called to account for just what they've been up to and why. And Michael Hudson talks about economic war, says that financiers, the rentier class, are now achieving what their forebears need to use guns to do: ownership and control of lots of property, turfing people out of their houses, which is, if you think about it, quite an impressive feat of mind control. Millions of people are being told by a very small number of people, you all need to leave your house. This is rather reminiscent of colonial days. A very small number of expats, another small number of locals working with them, and large number of people cowed by the threat of violence. And this is a threat that couldn't be materialized everywhere at once, couldn't be materialized very much at all. But nobody wants to be the first to stick their head above the parapet, to bell the cat, if you like, and say, all this rent that you want from us, it is impossible for us to pay, isn't it? As we've heard before several times on the show, the mathematics is not that complicated. What's perhaps more worthy of study is the psychological process, the trickery employed, whether through schooling, economics textbooks, news reports, or a whole manner of other methods, how the 99% are persuaded that they should be working very hard to keep up interest payments and to cover mortgages for the 1%. It's a kind of mass hypnosis. Most people don't stop and think about it. They just get on and do what everybody else is doing. There is a kind of a deceptive lobster trap that makes it very easy to get into debt and very hard to get out of it. The same way, it's the same set of principles that third world countries were given by the IMF and the World Bank. And yet it still manages to keep a hold over the public imagination. It's not just a matter of, oh, well, they'll catch us if we don't pay. A lot of people still feeling, well, we have to pay our debts. Morally speaking, it's the right thing to do.
Our message is very simple, and that is why it is threatening. From Margaret Thatcher to President Obama, you were told that there is no alternative. And we are here and will spend the next 2 days telling you that there is an alternative. And we will spell out what the alternative is. What we're seeing now is a fight for what is going to be the rest of the 21st century by creating a new kind of class. A new class much like the invasions of Europe 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago, invaders from the north and from Italy would grab land and grab public utilities by military means. But today, ever since the United States went off gold in 1971, aggressors can no longer afford military war. So what you have today is a new kind of a war. It's a financial war. You can get, by privatization and financialization, what armies used to get by force of arms. This is not the class war that people spoke of 100 years ago. It is a financial war. And it is a war that classical economists warned against. 300 years of classical political economy sought to get rid of landlords and bankers. 100 years ago, people spoke of technology. Nobody believed that the vested interests could fight back. But they did fight back in the way that parasites do in biological nature. I've read in the Italian newspapers coming over on the airplane that people talk about parasites. And people think of parasites as taking the host's energy and the lifeblood. But in biology, the smart parasites do something else. They take over the brain of the host. They make the brain think that the parasite is part of the body to be protected. In America, President Obama and Treasury Secretary Geithner says the economy cannot survive without bailing out the banks, without bailing out the debt, without making the gamblers and the kleptocrats whole on what they have taken. The production economy, the consumption economy, the real economy is being sacrificed to the financial sector. But matters don't have to be this way. There is an alternative, and we will be spelling out the alternative in the next 2 days. We're overwhelmed that so many of you are here. We're excited, and we will do our best to explain to you that there are many alternatives. And then it will be your turn to carry the fight on.
And that concludes the introduction to Michael Hudson's presentation, which we'll hear in just a minute. Just to pick up on one of those points, he's saying that the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, because they control the accounting system, are in a position to effectively dominate the political system, make the rules, the regulatory agencies, and so on. And he's saying that because they've captured that control mechanism, then the real economy, the good economy, is being sacrificed. They are like parasites. Now, it seems to me, just to look at that in a slightly larger perspective, perhaps human activity and the real world is suffering in a similar fashion from that small spectre of activity which is accounted for using money. In the very first episode of Unwelcome Guests, way back in March 2000, we heard from Marilyn Waring on the huge amount of women's work, whether it's cooking, cleaning, looking after kids, essential life-supporting activity, which, because it's given and it's not accounted for in a financial mechanism, is discounted, effectively deemed unimportant by the moneyed economy. And the fact that wage labour, normal capitalism, if you like, would be impossible without it. In the same way, it seems to me that the earth and the world gives so much in terms of breathable atmosphere, water, climate, which we're now noticing because of its absence or because of its scarcity. Michael Hudson's talking about wresting control from the fire sector, giving control back to normal economy, the productive economy. Seems to me perhaps we should think about the importance of the real world rather than things which are accounted through this abstract notion of money. That's just a thought to ponder with while we hear the rest of Michael Hudson's presentation.
I'm going to elaborate in a different direction from what Stephanie has said. I'm going to discuss the difference between central bank credit or money and commercial banks. Central banks create money, you can say, and commercial banks create credit. The last 3 years since September 2008 have seen the largest money creation and credit creation in history in the United States. And yet prices have not gone up at all. That is, consumer prices have not gone up. Since 1980, wages in the United States have drifted downwards for 30 years. And consumer prices and commodity prices have been stable. But there has been an immense inflation. The largest bond market price increase in history has occurred as interest rates have fallen from 20% to only 0.25% today. What has gone up is the price of real estate, the price of bonds, the price of stocks. So the result is that the value of wealth, and most wealth is held by the wealthiest 1% of the population, wealth has gone way up relative to wages. The result is a new kind of class war, as I said last night. It's not the typical class war between employers and employees. It's a war of finance against the economy. Under industrial capitalism, the idea was that credit would be created productively to fund capital investment that would employ labor. That is not what is occurring today. When commercial banks create credit, it is to create claims on wealth. It is create mortgage debt. It is create corporate debt. It is to create personal debt and student loans and credit card debt. This is what makes commercial bank credit creation different from the central bank's creation of money. When central banks create money, they do so for a long-term public purpose. They fund government spending and capital investment in public infrastructure. In most countries of the world, throughout history, public infrastructure, roads, communication systems, railroads, water and sewer systems, have all taken a capital investment that is larger than all of the manufacturing capital investment. In the United States, the value of New York City's real estate alone is larger than the value of all of the plant and equipment in the United States. So the result is the textbooks that are taught in the United States ignore this difference that we have been talking about. They are told there's a formula in English that's MV equals PT. It means an increase in the money supply increases the price level. But the price level that the textbooks talk about are only consumer prices and commodity prices. Nowhere in the textbooks do you find a relation between the credit supply and asset prices, real estate, stocks, and bonds. And yet 99% of the credit spent in the United States economy is spent on these financial claims. Every day, an amount equal to the entire year's gross national product passes through the New York Monetary Clearinghouse and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The vast amount of payments are within the financial sector. And in the last 10 years or so, all of the growth of bank lending is to other financial institutions. In the textbooks, there are happy pictures about banks lending to industry to build machines and factories with a smokestack coming out and employing labor. But this is a fiction. This is not what occurs in practice. All of the increased capital investment in the United States economy comes from the retained earnings of corporations, not from banks. Banks do not lend to bring new capital investment into existence. They lend against mortgages, against capital in place, against real estate, against assets that already exist, not to create new assets. So when we talk about government money, we talk about government spending that indeed is to spur the economy, to spur economic growth, to spur new investments. So the function of government investment and government central bank money creation is very different from the private banks. The government money is indeed debt. The lira that you have in your pocket are debt. Paper currency is debt. But it's debt that nobody ever expects to be repaid. Because if government currency is debt, then to repay it would mean that you would not have any currency left in the pocket. The commercial debt is expected to be repaid, and it bears interest. And as this commercial debt has grown, the mortgages, the bank loans to companies, the corporate rating debt, this has loaded down the economy with an enormous debt overhead. The more money commercial banks lend, the more interest has to be paid to carry this debt overhead. And the problem is that money that is spent on paying banks debt cannot be spent on goods and services. So the result is that when commercial banks create the debt, you have a diversion of income away from spending on goods and services to pay debt service, and that is known as debt deflation. And when debt deflation proceeds as long as it has today, we move into a late stage of finance capitalism, which is the debt deflation stage, the austerity stage. And that's the stage that Europe finds itself in today.
You're listening to financial economist and historian Michael Hudson at the Summit on Modern Money Theory in Rimini, Italy. Today's show, there is an alternative to European austerity, Modern Money Theory, MMT. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
There is a political aspect to all of this technical discussion of money. the political aspect is that if governments create money, then they're creating a mixed economy. A mixed economy of private and public capital investment. This is what made all of the countries of Europe and the United States rich. The government investment in the public infrastructure that has been able to be supplied to the economy at cost, so you get to drive on most roads for free, you get to use this huge capital investment in infrastructure for free. But if governments are not allowed to create their money, then all of the credit the economy needs is created by the commercial banks. And when the commercial bank credit creation leads to debt deflation and the government cannot finance the deficit to pay the interest, then the commercial banks say, all right, sell off and privatize your infrastructure. This is what we're seeing in Greece today, in Ireland. You've seen it in Iceland. What you are seeing is a financial grab of infrastructure that is taking place by the ability of commercial bankers to prevent the central bank from creating credit. And this is a vast new bank loans. Most of the infrastructure that is being purchased, the water and sewer systems, real estate, is all being bought with borrowed money from the banks. So the first of all, the commercial bank political strategy is to block the central bank from creating money and then saying the governments need to borrow from the commercial banks and need to pay interest to the commercial banks instead of issuing interest-free debt. And then to pay the interest, they have to sell off the infrastructure. And the result is that bankers today are able to seize the property that in the past it took a military invasion to see. So what you are seeing today is a new kind of warfare. It is a financial warfare against the entire society, not only against labor, but against industry, and most of all, against government. And a tool in this warfare is to convince people that government money creation is going to be inflationary. You have all seen in the last 30 years here in Italy that your prices have not gone up much, your wages have not gone up much, and what has gone up is the price of your houses, the price it takes to buy a house, that you have to take on a lifetime of debt in order to get a place to live. In America, students have to take a decade of debt to get an education, in order to get a job, instead of the government financing education freely, as was the ideal 100 years ago. In the textbooks, it is as if the economy operates without debt and on a barter basis. The reason they don't discuss what we are discussing here today is that they don't want you to realize that there is an alternative to commercial bank credit creation and a power grab. The Belgian poet Baudelaire said that the devil wins at the point where society believes that he doesn't exist. The financial sector wins at the point where you don't see that the prices the banks are inflating are asset prices, real estate prices, bond and stock prices, and that the role of commercial banks is to increase the power of wealth over the rest of the society, over labor, over industry, to create a new ruling class of bankers that are even more heavy than the landlords that were criticized in the last part of the 19th century. For 200 years, classical economics sought to purify industrial capitalism from the carryover of feudalism. And these carryovers were the private land ownership of a hereditary aristocracy and commercial banks that had held governments in debt and then foreclosed and exchanged their debt for monopolies. In Britain, this is how the trading companies were formed, the East India Company and the Bank of England with its monopoly. And in the United States, you had similar creations of monopolies through the railroads that became the largest landowners through land grant. What Balzac wrote in one of his novels was that behind every family fortune was a great theft, often an undiscovered one. And yet modern economics treats all of the theft, the capital transfer, the transfer payments that are occurring today, as if it were all productive, as if all income is earned. Every government in the world now prints national income and product accounts that say that rent is earnings of landlords, and interest is the earnings of the bankers. In the United States, the financial sector has 40% of all reported corporate earnings. So you have the shift of the economic surplus shifting away from industrial capital that's invested in new plant and equipment to hire labor to finance capital that is lent out, and the interest earned by the banks is lent out again. And the result is an exponential growth, which Americans called the magic of compound interest. The growth of compound interest is so large that it is much larger than any government's ability to pay. And so the result has to be default. And the default position that Europe and America finds itself in today is the point at which the financial sector makes its grab for assets and takes for itself the public domain, the public enterprises, the roads, the broadcasting systems, the ports and the harbors. And that is what is happening today. And the difference in privatizing these assets is that when you privatize the roads and the infrastructure, the buyers have to pay interest, they pay dividends, they pay exorbitant executive salaries, they pay financial fees to the underwriters, they offer stock options to the management, and then they raise the price of these public services to the highest rent extraction that they can charge. The economy is turned into a toll booth opportunity. Toll booths are placed on the access to housing, the access to roads, the access to telephone systems, the access to credit for the money that you use by credit cards in payments. And all of a sudden, instead of paying the cost of operating an economy, you're paying for the privileges of people, the financial sector, and what used to be called rentiers, that are simply charging whatever they can get and siphoning off the wealth into their own hands. So in the United States, the real economy of production and consumption has actually declined over the last 30 years. All of the growth in the economy is overhead to the rentier sector, to what we call the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, which now should include the legal system and the monopoly system. So almost without the textbooks or anyone noticing, what used to be analyzed as industrial capitalism has turned into finance capitalism. And this finance capitalism has not been the kind of finance that was imagined 100 years ago. It is not financing of industry. It's financing of economic parasitism and overhead. And all of this is presented as if the way to get rich is to go into debt, to borrow, to buy assets that are being inflated in price. When your real estate and your public enterprises have risen in price, this is not because they've actually grown. It is because a house and a property is worth whatever a bank will lend. And as the lending terms have been loosened, you've had this huge inflation in asset prices that is way beyond the ability of the economy to pay. Foreclosure time arrives, and so finance capitalism turns into a bubble economy, because the only way that banks can avoid default and a break in the chain of payments is to lend more money. In America, the Obama administration policy has been described as having to borrow your way out of debt. If people can't pay, the idea is to continue to borrow the money from the banks, and you simply add the interest onto the debt. This is how Latin America financed itself during the 1970s, until finally it couldn't pay, the debts had to be written down. Now, the end of this shift away from government, central bank, money creation, to commercial bank credit creation, is that there has to be a bankruptcy, a debt write down. The basic premise underlying my analysis is that a debt that can't be paid won't be. All of the Wall Street analysts I know realize that the debts can't be paid. The political question is, how won't they be paid? Will they not be paid by letting the banks foreclose? One quarter of all American real estate today owes more money on the mortgage than it actually is worth. That means one quarter of homeowners, almost 10 million people, could walk away from their property and come out ahead on a balance sheet. Donald Trump would walk away. Certainly Goldman Sachs walks away from bad investments. But individuals are told that their debt should be paid, that only the debts of the rich don't have to be paid. Only the debts of the 99% to the rich have to be paid. And there's a shift in understanding how the economy works. So the way to get rich today isn't really to borrow money and buy a property that you hope will rise in price, because when the price collapses, as they have today in America, Spain, Ireland, England, when the price crashes, the debts remain in place, and there's the negative equity that occurs. This is the point at which property is transferred from debtors to creditors, so that the way to make money today is to get the 99% of the population into debt to the 1% of the population. It's not really to borrow. Never in history before was there any temporary period where people thought that the way to get rich was to go into debt. They were tricked into that by junk economics. When Alan Greenspan told American homeowners, borrow against the value of your house, go into debt, treat your house like a piggy bank, and sustain your living standards that your wages are no longer paying for. So while the American workers have to pay to send their children to school and to get an education, to pay for what used to be publicly supported, you've had the banks all of a sudden financialize education, financialize the public sector, and even financialize the corporate sector and the industrial sector. The stock market in the textbooks is presented as a means of financing industry and providing equity capital that's not debt, that is a means for industry to make investment and hire labor. But that's not what has occurred for the last 30 years. The stock market has become a vehicle for corporate raiders and management buyouts to borrow money, to buy a company, to calculate how much profit a company makes, to pay the profit to the bankers, and to be able to buy a company just like a real estate investor would buy a building. When a real estate investor, whether it's Donald Trump in America or Italian and European investors, want to buy a commercial property, they calculate how much rent it'll yield, they bid against each other, And the winning bidder is whoever is willing to pay the most rent to the bank to get the mortgage to buy the property. That's what's called using other people's money. But it really isn't other people's savings. It's freshly created money that banks create on their own computer keyboards. And they can create this freely by simply writing a bank account for the borrower, and the borrower signs an IOU, whether it's a mortgage debt or a personal debt, to pay off at interest. Now, the banks say that this is not inflationary, that only government money creation is inflationary, and yet there's no reason why the government can't go to its own computers and electronically create money in exactly the same way that commercial banks create credit. The question is, why should the government be called inflationary by creating money and commercial banks not be called inflationary when they create credit, when you've seen that the banks are inflationary? They make their money by getting people to pay all of the rent or all of the corporate profits, hoping to come out with a capital gain. And in the United States, the corporate raiders and the leveraged buyout companies make a capital gain by cutting costs, by cutting wages, by downsizing the labor force, by outsourcing it to other countries, and especially by seizing the pension funds and using the pension funds to pay off the bankers and write down the debt so they have more equity. A few years ago, in Chicago, where I grew up, Sam Zell, a real estate operator, borrowed the money to buy the Chicago Tribune. He took over the Chicago Tribune, which was the biggest paper. He looted the employee stock ownership plan. He used the money to pay the creditors that lent him the money to buy the Chicago Tribune. He began to fire the staff. He sold off the Chicago Cubs, the baseball team that the Chicago Tribune owned. And then, even so, he mismanaged the company so badly that the company went bankrupt, wiping out the employee stockholders. They have brought a case of fraud against him, claiming that they have had their money stolen. President Obama recently gave a speech saying, there is no fraud. It's all legal. That's the free market. The free market has been redefined to be free for the financial sector to grab, to misrepresent, and to do the things that Professor Bill Black is going to be talking about in his talk. So when you talk about the fraud that has essentially become the basis for making financial money, you have that as the new form, the new economy, without anybody saying it. I don't know any textbook that talks about how the way to get rich is to steal money. The way to get rich is to borrow money to buy a property that's going up in value and make the economy shrink and grab property from the public domain. Why is it that French novelists like Balzac and poets like Baudelaire understand the economy better than what Nobel Prizes are given in the textbooks that are written today? Why would one go to movies and drama rather than a textbook? What we are trying to do in this meeting today is to give you a new view of how the real economy works and teach reality economics instead of the parallel universe that you have in economic textbooks. At the beginning of Paul Samuelson's textbook, which is used to indoctrinate students in the United States, he says that the criterion of economic theory is whether its axioms are consistent. This is what I was told when I studied literature in college. If you're reading a novel, you have to suspend disbelief. You have to believe in the science fiction or the characters that the author writes and imagine that it's all consistent. You know, when you go to a movie and after you come out of a thriller or a mystery movie, you think, wait a minute, there's something wrong with that picture. They forgot how it happened. What Mr. Samuelson did not say was that these assumptions have to be realistic. So instead of learning how the economy operates, students are told how a parallel universe might operate on a different planet if there were no government, if there were no fraud, if the entire economy operated on barter, if there was no debt, and that everybody wanted to help everybody else, that nobody inherited money, that everybody earned all of the income and wealth that they have. The reality is the opposite, but it seems to be talked about only in novels these days. Whenever you have a misunderstanding of reality, year after year, decade after decade, and now for a century, when a false picture of the economy is painted, you can be sure that there is a special interest that's benefiting. A false picture of reality does not happen by nature. It is subsidized. And the banking sector has subsidized a junk economics that is taught in the universities, broadcast from your newspapers, mouthed by the politicians whose election they sponsor, to try to make you believe that you're living on Mars in a different kind of a world instead of the actual country that you're living in, and to pretend that there is no financial class that is trying to grab what belongs to the public at large. This is what ends up with the difference between central bank creation by the government, with the government aims of economic growth and full employment, as compared to commercial bank credit that aims at economic shrinkage, at austerity, at lower wages, at lower output, so that it can do to you what the commercial banks are doing to Greece. To say, give us your ports and your land and your tourist areas and your water and sewer systems so we can charge you for water and sewer. And we can take the money that you had expected to get in pensions and we can scale it down so that we can pay ourselves. This is what it took an army in times past. And today it's done without an army. As long as you will be passive and believe the science fiction picture of the world that the banks are painting.
And for all this talk about sensible economic policy, I think that's almost an oxymoron. It seems to me that the real world is what we must be concerned with, and notions about money, about interest, investment, and any other imaginary concepts should take second place, if at all. Now, I know that would seem like quite a jump, perhaps even to Michael Hudson and Stephanie Kelton. I don't think that would seem like such a jump to David Graeber, who is not an economist. Certainly, he has a lot of perspective on the matter. And now we're going to carry on reading from Chapter 10, The Middle Ages. He makes the point that many of us will think about medieval Europe. I know I do when I think of the Middle Ages. Well, medieval Europe really wasn't where it was happening. Medieval Europe was kind of an outpost where a lot of innovations, ideas taken for granted in Asia and the Muslim world hadn't taken root in Europe. So he's going to be looking in our second hour more at the Muslim approaches to business and why, even to this day, Muslim commerce tends to be rather circumspect about government. Now, is that perhaps why the Muslim world suits the imaginary target of the Great War on Terror? Yeah, I'm sure the oil reserves have a lot to do with it. I'm speculating here. I think it's time for reading from David Graeber.